Eventually, people began to recognize that we have four more senses. Taste, touch, sound, hearing, and smell. So we have five tools, in a sense, at our disposal to get in touch with that world out there. But is sense perception a valid or a sound basis for knowing things? Our senses began to evoke, among the Greeks, very severe criticisms. Is there an objective reality that can be attached to senses? Or are senses utterly subjective? If, for example, I listen to a piece of music and find it pleasing, well, that's an interesting problem right away. What does that statement mean? I was pleased. How do we understand that? Well, let's suppose for the moment that's not problematic, and we really basically know what I just said. But perhaps you will be pleased by a different piece of music. Now, how has the sense of sound communicated valid and replicable information? I like asparagus. I don't know if you do. Lots of people don't. Does asparagus taste good or taste bad? If I say asparagus tastes wonderful, but you don't like asparagus, have I actually communicated anything to you? Have I told you anything? Do you now know something? Well, you might say, yes, I know that you like asparagus. So we've posed the problem in a sense of secondhand knowledge. Suppose a blind person, and you tell the blind person the sky is blue. Now, the blind person knows for sure that you have told him or her that the sky is blue. The blind person may think you're a reliable person and they ought to believe you and you're generally credible and so on. But does that person actually know something, or do they know what you told them? How much of what we know is at second or at third or at fourth hand? And is not personal observation, and is not in any meaningful sense objective, but in fact subjective. So does all knowledge exist only in relation to me? Can only I know things, and you, and you, and you, and you, and you, but that we don't know things? That's an interesting problem. Now, with the critique of the senses, there began to arise a critique of language. Let's suppose for a moment there are things to be known. Let's suppose for a moment that knowing them, getting in touch with them, is unproblematic. Clearly it is. But let's suppose for the sake of argument that these are not problems. Now I have the problem of communicating what I know. I have one tool to do this, language. You may say I could communicate in other ways. I could do it with painting. I could do it with music. This is entirely true. And it's entirely true that we can think of those things as language, as tools of communication. But the point here is that they are no less ambiguous, no less difficult, no less complicated than the language that is ordinary words. Imagine a very simple sentence. Dog bites man. That occasions no problem. Now I'll use those exact same three words. Man bites dog. It's only by a trick of syntax, of organization, that I have changed the meaning utterly. But the words are all the same. Do words convey meaning? Or is language a series of artifices that may be designed as much to conceal as to reveal? Is language itself ambiguous and communicates, well, something, but how much? 25%, 50%, 100%? What is the nature of language, and how does it work to communicate what we think we know? So, philosophy has begun posing a series of very interesting puzzles for itself. Now, in the midst of this musing over these answers to the three questions I posed, what's out there, how do we know, what should I do, in southern Italy, think for a moment about Greek colonization. Think for a moment about Magna Graecia, the transition of a lot of those Greeks over to southern Italy and to Sicily. And over in that part of the world, there was a thinker who had created a kind of a brotherhood around himself. This was Pythagoras, who flourished in the late 6th century B.C. Pythagoras' idea, in a certain way, he's going back to Anaxagoras. He's going back to the idea of mind. He's thinking that the only way we're going to get in touch with the world is to think very long and hard about it. And in thinking about the world and using mind to comprehend reality, we're going to have to try to keep ourselves to the formulation of law-like principles that always work, that are replicable, that work again and again, that work without subjectivity. So he feels that to gain true knowledge, one must live a life dedicated to intense thought. A couple of examples serve very well to show sort of what Pythagoras was up to and the implications of his thinking. And some of these implications we'll see, we'll encounter again.